Blog Talk Radio.
On Heights, Blessed Souls, is a time and space which is occupying within the 16th day of Maheshvan, 5,771 years ago, or today I should say, in the present, blazing and grazing in creation, also corresponding to October 24th, 2010. This is Soul Class number 26, which should be a special show, we hope, because what we hope to generate today are more meditations on the Torah portion in Balak. And this will be starting from chapter 23, verse 1. And we'll be going further and hope to be joined with some guests to join in on the meditation. Before we do that, Blessed Soul, I'd like to read to you, as I was just talking with musician, reggae musician extraordinaire, Joseph Ezra, whose song kicked off the show, Prophets Return, because that's what we want, Blessed Souls. We want the prophets of Israel, we want the prophets of all nations, of the blessed children of Noach, to return, to guide us, because this creation right now needs a lot of guidance, a lot of infighting, a lot of baseless hatred, a lot of unnecessary competition. We should really just be competing within ourselves to better ourselves. And, of course, a lot of jealousy. Unfortunately, I have to report that to you. But let's go back, way, way back into the beginning of the creation within the context of when the Most High made us. And it's written in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. And the Creator said, quote, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness. They shall rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and over the animals, the whole earth, and every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." Verse 27, "The Almighty made man in his image, in the image of the Most High." He created him, male and female. He created them. Verse 28 in chapter 1, you see it's written, Hashem, the Most High Creator, blessed them, and he said to them, quote, "Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. And rule over the fish of the sea, the earth of the sky, and everything that moves on the earth." Let's see what our caller is. Let's see if we have one caller in. Yes, caller. Hello. Caller, can you please chime in? Hello. Hello, caller. Yes. Caller, let's see.
Shalom,
yes,
Brother Dunn.
Oh, Joseph Israel, as I just mentioned you a minute ago, reggae music extraordinaire, but a human being even more extraordinary. And Joseph, I'm just trying, I have a couple of callers trying to come in the production. Let's just see. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, Dennis?
Yes, Don.
How you doing? We have Joseph Israel on the line, and we're going to click in now Ron Williams. Ron.
Good morning, Joseph. Good morning, Don.
Oh, okay, good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
Okay, gentlemen, let's just clarify. We have Dennis Ryan from, looks like Long Island. We got Joseph Israel, and we have Ron Williams by the JFK Airport. And this is Don Zofio Goodman. We're live from Kesser, Iriat's Kana. Gentlemen, good morning to everyone.
Yes, Boker Tovu.
Good morning.
Boker Tovu.
Greetings, Dennis. I don't think I've met you before, even on the phone. So nice to have you on this show.
Likewise. Greetings.
Okay. Gentlemen, I just chimed in with the beginning of the show, reading from chapter 1, verses 26, 27, and 28. And I spoke to Joseph a couple minutes before the show, Dennis and Ron, about how I think we have a new strategy, which I think will work in terms of spreading these teachings and meditations, that we have to remind human beings they have a divine image. That doesn't make us divine beings, but that we are imbued with godly attributes going back to the beginning of the creation. And I thought of a meditation that goes like this: how good and pleasant it will be before God and man to see the unification of all the divine image clan. You know that refers to you. You know that refers to me. But we have to get together and work on a collective, universal, peaceful reality. Who would like to chime in and give some feedback on this statement?
Well, it's very important, Don, you know, as you know, that I sing about this stuff, and, you know, people have to, you know, the thing is to awaken people to realize that they come from the Most High, and they're actually, especially in Genesis, it lets us know that he made a special creation when he created the human race, and, you know, and that he created us to be a reflection of him, and that is all of us, no matter what, you know, what clan that you come from or what tribe, or, you know, whether you come out of Asia or Africa or America or any other, Israel or any other place, we all are created in that image. The thing also is that we've fallen short of that image, but we're here to awaken that so that we can reflect the Most High's love and wisdom and power and justice within this creation to each other, and this is a way that we'll really be praising him. More than we could say a bunch of prayers and all these things, and those are very important, but if we're not living to strive to be like our Father, then you know, it's not really working. So we got to really make sure that universal love is being spread and that we can wake up each other, because we sharpen each other, you know, and it's very important. I like that little poem there.
Thank you. Well, part of it was inspired by you. Dennis or Ron, we'd like to chime in on these
Well, the poem was nice, but most people believe we were made in his image in some way, shape,
mm-hmm.
or form. Therefore, we
mm-hmm.
must follow his path.
Mm-hmm. Ron, would you like to chime
okay.
in?
So, what I would like to say is that most people are aware of that to a certain extent, but what we don't remember, what we have to always keep in mind is that when we actually view each other in different situations, we still have to keep that in mind. And in no way we should try to demean each other, because when we do, we should remember what we're actually demeaning is the image of God, and not just the other person with the free will who did whatever he did, he or she did. And once we keep this in mind, we will be reflecting our divine image.
It's true, Ron, and because we are all made in his image, that if we do anything against the image, we're doing something against him, and we don't want that to happen, right?
Right, that's it.
And also, in like today in school and for this last 100 years or whatever, they've been teaching that they teach actually the exact opposite, you know, that actually man is a descendant of some evolution of a beast, and so, you know, that is one of the main problems, and the reason why I don't let my kids go to public school, because we will refuse to let them teach such a terrible thing to our children, you know, which is unscientific, but they teach it as scientific, and that actually it's so important to instill that we are created in the Most High's image, you know. So that's another point, is that a lot of people, maybe they've heard that before, but they most people, even a lot of Christians and stuff, still lean towards evolution. Even a lot of preachers, a lot of people are still trapped in that mentality, you know, because they somehow believe science more than the prophets. But like what I just said, you know, it's not even scientific if you really study into it. So the real biology is we come in the image of the Most High. And,
well, we must look for what we have in common as opposed to our differences.
Mm-hmm.
And God has made everything. So we all emanate from God. To see the differences is to distract from what is goodness and what is godness.
But only man he made in his image, only the human race.
That is absolutely correct.
True. Ron and Joseph, I spoke with Dennis late last week, and what Dennis we vibe out on is a very important book that was written by Rambam Maimonides, and it's called Guide to the Perplexed. Dennis, before we get to the main body of today's program, which is to, you know, dialogue and meditate upon the teachings from the Torah portion of Balak, which will be, if anyone wants to pull out a Chumash or a Bible, we'll be starting from chapter 3, verse 1. Do you have handy the Guide to the Perplexed, and maybe read a couple of lines and can vibe on that as the, so to speak, opening scrimmage to get into the teachings about Bilaam and his dealings with Israel?
I always keep my Guide to the Perplexed handy, Don. Because to me, it's a reaffirmation of everything I learned, and it's a confirmation of what is God and what is goodness.
Beautiful. It's a great book.
Have you read it, Joseph?
I've read some of it. Yeah, I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I've read, a lot of it.
To read the whole thing is an exercise in your mind that uses every part of your mind just to stay with the Rambam.
Beautiful. So, Dennis, can you read a couple of lines and we can all vibe off it?
Where would you like me to start reading, Don?
Where we picked off from last week, when we were learning with someone else, from chapter 1, we talked about this whole idea that that people have made a mistake in terms of understanding this whole idea of the in the image of God, and they kind of made it, they corporealized it, as opposed to, it's not really something to be corporealized. It's more of a shining from Him that should inspire us to be more godly, as we're dialoguing on. So maybe, you know, maybe the second paragraph, the Hebrew says, but the image that's said is a natural type of design. Something like that should be, I think you would find something written along those lines in the English translation.
Well, the term that he uses is zelem, and I don't have the right pronunciation of it, because some people use a T sound to say that word, no?
Well, it's like a tsetse fly. You would pronounce it zelem. Zelem.
Zelem. Zelem.
Zelem. Zelem, yeah.
Right. Well,
so
he says, he says that I hold that the Hebrew equivalent of the word of form, in the ordinary exception of the word, the figure in the shape of the thing, is todar, T-O-D-R. Thus we find, and Joseph was beautiful in todar, form, and beautiful in appearance. That is Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
What todar is he of? That comes from Samuel, and the form Todah, the children of the king, judges. It is also applied to form produced by human labor, as in, he marketh the form with a line. and he marketh the form with a compass. That comes from Isaiah. The term is not, this term is not all applicable to God. The term Zelim, on the other hand, signifies a specific form that which contributes the essence of the thing, whereby the thing is what it is. The reality of the thing is so far is that it is that particular being. In man, the form is the constituent which gives us him human perception. And on account of the intellectual perception of the word Zelim is employed in the sentence, in the Zelim of God, he created him.
I'd like to chime in now. Now, you mentioned a couple of verses, if anyone would like to look them up, in terms of the whole idea of Toar, of appearance, that one can go to in Genesis 39:6, and then the book of Samuel, book 1, chapter 28, verse 14, in the book of Judges, chapter 8, verse 18, and the book of Isaiah, Prophet Isaiah, Yeshayahu, 44:13. Gentlemen, from what I understand, this whole idea of being beautiful in appearance and you know, to others, is that, you know, there's a certain spiritual quality that certain individuals have manifested, you know, from the times of the Bible, the Torah, and to this day. And this is the type of human being of any nation, really, that can combine in a proper symbiotic or synthesis of mixing together spirituality and living a physical life. Because really, you know, the Most High Hashem, he wants us to integrate, you know, the paradox of our, so to speak, our minds constantly focusing on look at the heaven and see who created these, and actually, you know, working and refining and elevating this earth, not just for oneself, but for other people. So we have people like Joseph, the righteous Joseph from, you know, the son of Yaakov, Israel. He was that blend. I mean, he was working in the commercial center of the world at the time, so to speak, the America of that time, you know, which was ancient Egypt. And yet he wasn't corrupted in a society which was heavily given over to corruption. And he maintained his spiritual plane of existence. So that was his true beauty. We also see someone like, say, Esther, who, you know, it's written that she was not necessarily the most physically beautiful woman in the world, but she found what is known as chen, as grace, in the eyes of the king. Achashverosh, at a crucial point when she fasted for 3 days, yet her sole intention in fasting 3 days was to get to a certain point where actually, despite human calculations that if a person fasts for 3 days, they'll look unbecoming, she actually looked very graceful and beautiful to the king. And then, you know, the whole story ensued there where she made a meal with wine being served between her, Haman, and Ahasuerus, and then a second one, and then that led to the downfall of Haman. So, gentlemen, I'd like you all to chime in on what characteristics perhaps you find, you know, they can be biblical characters or modern-day people you've met, where they seem to be, you know, actually portraying and acting as living examples of how to blend spirituality according to the level with living physical lives, and people get a feel good about them because they're blending the physical and the spiritual together. Who would like to speak first?
Well, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, that have inspired me on that level because, you know, basically, we're just in this world, and you actually the first sign of that type of thing you will notice in a human before you know, you know, for me, I noticed it in a human before I could really understand what the scriptures were even talking about, you know. And so there was a few people in my life, like my uncle, you know, his name is Steve, and he was just someone who always took time to reason and to think things out, and always had time to share a good word and with me as a young child, you know. And I was always there on the simplest form when I was a child. And as I grew up, you know, in the teenage years, of course, he's the one that gave me some of the great reggae music to help inspire me. But he's always there to show me, you know, to explain to me about gardening and just the ways of the earth and the ways of the Most High, and he always would come with challenging thoughts that would help me. They were little sparks that helped me, and so, you know, that's what I saw in him, you know, and I still do. It's a slight difference, you know. If someone on the outside might not see it, but when they begin to speak or you begin to live around someone like that, you can definitely tell a difference, that they live a different life than most, you know. And you know, also, I mean, obviously, Bob Marley and people like that have brought those attributes out to millions. And, you know, this other man, like, who's very wonderful, he's not necessarily a biblical scholar or anything, but Nelson Mandela has possessed a lot of mental power and ability, restraint, compassion, and universal love. And if you study about him, he's a pretty amazing man in our time, you know. He was, you know, there's obviously all the prophets and the writers of the scriptures are the ultimate examples. But that's my input.
His ability to sit, he's had 27 years in prison.
And then come out and forgive the people that put him in prison.
That's a pretty high level.
He's
Ron, or Dan, would you like to chime in on, you know, someone you've seen, not necessarily a biblical figure, that, you know, was a significant influence on your life, or you perceive him being a significant influence, or he or she, I should say, on other people?
I've been fortunate enough to work for a kosher cheese company for the past 20 years, where I'm actually the only Benoch in that company. And I've basically watched, observed very close, on a very close and sometimes even on an intimate level. When I say intimate, I mean in terms I was invited. I'm always invited to all of their simchas, their weddings, bar mitzvahs, and unfortunately also the vias. But I've viewed them, and I realized that each person possesses a specific character that makes up a whole in which you can learn from everyone, and how everyone accentuates a certain strength. And from this is where I've been able to gather so far a kind of a oneness of an example of which to follow, or try to emulate. And for me, this has been my most influential experience in terms of, for me, for the past 20 years, dealing so intense and, you know, close with the people I work with.
Dennis, anyone that you'd like to share?
I always like to hear Ron speak about the word spiritual, because in human terms, the word spiritual cannot be seen. It must be felt. And if you can't see it, it's hard sometimes to identify it, yet it becomes personal because it must exist in your mind. And the one thing I learned about reading about the Rambam is you find it in your communication with God, because it's highly personal, and you can only hope that other people feel it like you feel it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a heavy point. I just want to bring up one point. I mentioned a term that Esther found grace in the eyes of King Ahasuerus. Now, very interesting word for Hebrew. The word English for grace in the word Hebrew means chen. Now that word, gentlemen, and for any souls listening in, is actually the same letters as the Hebrew word for chen, which means grace. So when we talk about Noach or the children of Noach, which really were all children of Noach, that all the children of Noach are also the children of Chen, of grace. So again, part of what I hope to, in these continuing radio shows and other communication efforts, face-to-face interaction with people, is try to educate people about that in their DNA, spiritual DNA, they have grace. They're not just children of Noach, they're children of grace. And I think that when people lose sight of the fact that not only although they know it, but they don't know how to integrate it into their physical daily lives, even in the most mundane activities, their awareness of their divine image, and also the fact that they have a certain grace, each one according to their blessing. And I know that also that, for instance, the second Lubavitch Rebbe, of Dov Meir Lubavitch, that he wrote in an introduction to his seminal work on the Book of Unification, that he wished that the Mota would bless every man with grace. I mean, but why would he bless every man with grace? It was grace. The blessing is that a person should come to connect with their own sense of inner grace. And Joseph mentioned as well before about Bob Marley. I read something very interesting about him within the last week, that one of perhaps the secrets to his life story and success is that he was at home with himself. He felt comfortable being himself. I'm not talking about as a rock star, a reggae star, a musician, but essentially as a human being. Because, you know, when we take one step back from our family and friends and community, it's and we close our eyes for a moment, it's really just us and the Most High for those few moments. And then we have to figure out, well, if it's just me and the Most High and myself, how do I integrate that awareness with my family, with my friends, with my community, at my job peers, with my bosses? Anyone like to chime in this on, you know, part of educating people about the inner grace, and inner divine image, that they should feel comfortable with who they are as a recognition of the blessings they got from the Most High, to be who they are, whatever world, part of the world they come from. Anyone like to chime in on that?
Well, there is an old saying, know thyself. If you can't mm-hmm. know yourself, how are you going to know others, and how are you going to understand God? So you must come to peace and recognize what you have, because you have to use it.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Joseph or Ron?
Go on, Ron. Go on.
No, go ahead, Joseph.
Okay. I think that's really the key, you know, to unlocking mm-hmm. the door and is self-discovery and, you know, this is what we're striving to do, and you know, every day to me, I'm still learning so much about myself to be able to activate new parts. I mean, it's like I think that's the lifelong quest is to, even, you know, of course, to understand the Most High, but also to understand what the Most High has given us. And you know, my grandfather used to always tell me, you know, what we are is God's gift to us, but what we become is our gift to God, you know? So that was the wisdom he always told me.
Nice.
Beautiful.
Ron. Yeah. Ron.
In the same spirit of what Dennis said, know thyself, there's also a saying I grew up hearing, to thine own self be true. And if you actually, you look at yourself in a truthful fashion, you will see the beauty is within yourself, but it only comes with the acceptance of who you actually are. Because once you're comparing or trying to be someone else, the beauty just evades you all the time. Because God created each of us individually, because that's what His desire, who we are, is who He desired that we should actually be. The only thing we have to do now is to accept that and continue to do His work with that acceptance in mind. And then we're doing the work He designed for us, the way He designed us for Him, instead of trying to do something that was designed for someone else or to be someone else who He did not desire for us to be. So for me, that's what I'm actually working on now.
Very good.
Beautiful. Okay. So I'd like to know yes, go ahead, then.
I said those were beautiful words, and those are the words that help us to convert people who don't see or understand what God is all about. Because we must lay the foundation there, like you say in the Noahide, is to lay the foundation so people can understand themselves and have a better understanding of God.
That's very true. And like also what was brought up is that it's how we perceive other people too. If we can discover that in ourselves, then we automatically have to make that you know, we have to see that in all other people, no matter what they're choosing. And if we begin to see that in them, maybe they'll be able to see that in themselves. When I came off the airplane the other day, that's what I said to myself. Everybody in this airport, you know, in San Francisco, there's so many, is every kind of person. It's like New York, you know. So I just looked at everybody when I came off the airplane. I said, these are all the Most High creatures. These are all His creation. You know, I mean, without a judgment, I, you know, don't judge how someone's dressed or what they're doing, or, you know, it's like I'm trying to train my mind to perceive it that way, you know, because it's so easy to be judgmental, you know. Yep. And but if we don't, it's okay to judge, oh, I don't want to do that for myself, or this isn't the right way, but you still have to see that these people are the Most High's people, and don't dehumanize them. And you know, it just was an amazing thought just to come off the airplane and to see all these different people and to train my mind to see it that way, you know, because we're trained to be divided, you know. That's how this world has trained people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have the same feelings, only I look at all those other people and say, how come they don't realize what we all have in common?
True.
Yeah. You know what that is? Then we take upon ourselves the obligation to explain to other people that commonality among us, which is that divine image and that inner grace that we have as all being common descendants of Noah.
That's very true.
Gentlemen, I'd like to go to chapter 23, verse 1 in the book of Numbers, and we'll start off. We'll read several verses without any of the commentaries because it's so straightforward. And we talked about these verses, I think, in the last show. I think I did with Ron. So chapter 23, verse 1 in Balaam, or Bilaam, but the Balak, I want you to build me 7 altars and prepare for me 7 bulls and 7 rams. 23:2, and Balak did as Bilaam or Balaam had spoken, and Balak and Bilaam offered up a bull and a ram on every altar. So that was 14 animal sacrifices. And then Balaam said to Balak in verse 3, chapter 23, stand by your burnt offering, and I will go, and perhaps the Almighty will come to greet me, and he'll show me whatever he has to show me, and then I'll tell you. And he went to the bear height, which is very interesting, that Bilaam, as a Noahite, instructing Balak, they offered a burnt offering. Now, according to the 7 Noahide commandments, this is an acceptable sacrifice that can be offered by the Noahites. Of course, we don't encourage anyone to do it, although the truth is, according to the law today, a Noahite can, in fact, offer up an offering of a sacrifice of what's known as a korban, or a burnt offering sacrifice, which is used to atone for negative thoughts, which could lead to negative intentions. And the truth is, you know, we, those of us who are aware and trying to connect to that commonality and try to educate people to think good, this really is even a greater sacrifice too. Because we, all of us, you know, we could offer, I mean, I'm not allowed to, as a Jew, as an Israelite, to offer a sacrifice these days. But to me, it's a greater sacrifice to switch the energy of negative thinking to the power of positive thinking. So with that being said, in verse 4, chapter 23, and the Most High told Bilaam, he said, the 7 altars what Bilaam said to God, the 7 altars I prepared, and I have offered up a bullock and a bull and a ram on every altar. And then in verse 5, chapter 23, and the Creator put a word in Bilaam of Balaam's mouth and said, return unto Balak, and thus you shall speak. In chapter 3, verse 6, and he returned unto him, and behold, he stood by his burnt offering, he and all the princes of Moab. So here we see Balak had already offered up these sacrifices as Bilaam or Balaam had commanded him or instructed him. And the Most High told Bilaam what he should say. And Bilaam said the following. Bilaam, this is Balaam, or Bilaam speaking. Chapter 23, verse 7. And he took up his prop and said, from Aram, bring me Balak, the king of Moab. From the mountains, come curse me, Jacob, and come to cause, you know, basically disaster to the nation of Israel. So previously, although it's not written specifically in the written for in the oral Torah tradition, as Rashi, who was the primary commentator on scripture, the 5 books of Moses, that Balak had suggested to him, advised him, that he should curse them using the name of, curse Israel, and also curse the name of Jacob, or Yaakov in Israel. So here's the response of Bilaam, who was told by the Most High to say this, chapter 23, verse 8. How shall I curse what the Most High has not cursed? And how can I cause, basically, disaster who the Almighty has not planned to cause disaster? And from this point, gentlemen, from chapter 3, verse 9, I'll read it, and then I'd like you all to chime in here. So, because forth from the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I behold him, behold, it is a people that dwells alone an abomination shall not reckon itself. So Rashi mentions that what Bilam was alluding to in this proverb is, I gaze at their beginning and at the first of their roots, and I see them established and strong as these rocks and these hills. But the rocks and the hills are alluding to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the matriarchs, Sarah, Rebecca, Rivka, Leah, and Rachel, and Rachel. And this is what, you know, was bequeathed on us, that we dwell alone, but not in physical isolation to other nations or the Noahites, but actually in a way that our primary dwelling in this world is to learn the Torah, to teach the Torah, to pray, and to teach acts of kindness. So would anyone like to chime in? I just chewed a lot off the bit right now, commenting on these verses, and anyone want to chime in?
Well, I'm not a big fan of biblical verses because I have a hard time understanding them. But after reading the Rambam in the Guide to the Perplexed, I have a better understanding of the concept and the intention, which is far more important in terms of how the Rambam explained a lot of this.
Hello?
Most of it is allegorical, and he said, don't get hung up
not hearing
on a
you.
Number.
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, I can hear.
Can you hear me, Don?
Hello?
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 Hello? Shalom.
Yeah, for some reason, I didn't hear anyone. I lost you.
We're all here.
Okay, then
I turned your ears off
to that
from
point?
One. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah,
I hear.
Keep going,
speak,
Dennis.
Speak, Dennis.
Keep going.
You're saying you were not a fan of the verse until you started reading the Rambam, yeah?
Yeah, what happens is he said most of the sayings and the wordings are allegorical. And if you don't understand the concept and the intention, the spiritual scripture will be lost. So he started explaining it, saying that it's the intention and the concept that are more important than the exact word, as well as getting hung up on a number, like seven you used. He said the word seven is a reference. It was meant and had intention at the time, but today it still has some meaning, but not in the number itself. It is the concept that is very important.
Hmm. Joseph, or I'd like to comment on that, and Joseph and Ron, if you'd like to comment on Dennis or anything else you want to bring up.
Go ahead, Don. Say what you want to say first.
Well, I would like to say this, that I'm not exactly sure to that point where Rambam is saying that the verses are allegorical, because, you know, when Israel was getting oppressed in Egypt, that wasn't allegorical, that was actual. And when Moses had prophecy and he spoke words of prophecy, although one can see certain things that are allegorical, like the Ten Commandments are not allegorical, they are what they are, meaning, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, and before me you should have no other gods. There's nothing allegorical about that. That's plain and simple. The keeping of Shabbat is not allegorical, although it can be understood that way, but we literally, to this day, for the last 3,322 years, we keep the Shabbat. We avoid eating certain types of foods. There was nothing allegorical in the verses about the dietary laws. So I hear what you're saying, and I understand from a certain context what the Rambam is saying, but there happens to be a Hebrew acronym, which I'll spell it out. It's called, you would pronounce it in Hebrew, Pardes, which the P sound of Pardes means pshat, the simple understanding of Scripture. The R sound, the Remez, is the Torah sometimes hints in the Scripture. In the written word, there's a hinting, which could be alluding to the level Rambam's talking about. And then Drush are like the ethical teachings. Not already the right, the do's and don'ts are can be learned out from the simple understanding, where it says, do not murder. There's nothing allegorical about that. That means literally a person should not murder. Do not steal. Nothing allegorical about that. One should not steal. So the ethical teachings of Drush, and then Sod, which are the inner dimensions, which people associate with Kabbalah today, and we in the Lubavitch Hasidic movement understand that as a Hasidic movement, Hasidut, and or inner dimensions of Torah. This is more like the physics of the Torah, because the whole Torah really is a study of energy and matter, divine energy you know, dealing with corporeal matter, and sometimes the matter is unaware of the energy that's interacting with it. Like, for instance, you know, if we were to interview a rock, if we all of us were to walk out of our dwellings and talk to a rock, we wouldn't get too much response from the rock, you know. If we want to get a response from a rock, we could maybe crush it and then study its chemical compounds. If we were to, you know, we would try to interview water, we wouldn't get too much response from the water, but we could test the water for its chemical properties. And you understand where I'm going with it, gentlemen. So I hear what you're saying, Dennis, about the Rambam, but there are certain literal teachings that cannot contradict what the Rambam is saying. And at the same time, too, Rambam didn't really come to take away the literal understanding of Torah. Like, for instance, if you read about King David and King Solomon, which some people are now saying they didn't really exist, I mean, they did in fact exist, because to this day we have descendants of King David and Solomon, you know, living on the earth. Anyone like to comment?
Well, let me just put it another way. Let's put it this way. The Ten Commandments require no interpretation. They are direct and absolute.
Right. Yet, well, I just wanted to say, you know, I think there's both, you know, because let's just look at it from this perspective. The Most High swore in his wrath that the children that he took out of Egypt would not enter into his rest. And later on, King David says, "Today, if you will hearken to his voice, do not rebel as in the wilderness." And because the Most High was promising a greater rest, and it even says through Mashiach, his rest will be glorious. And you know, and he actually, everything in Torah can be seen through allegory, and this will be the ultimate fulfillment, because even the children of Israel, even the tabernacle, even the temple, all these things are symbolic of heavenly things. I mean, the tabernacle was a vision. He made it as a copy of what he saw in heaven, and the Holy of Holies and the holy section and the courtyard, these all are representations of different things. Of, you know, the different levels, and I mean, we don't have time to go into all of it, but there is such deep level, and when we get into that, it's so amazing. But what's really amazing also is that it actually was historical fact, you know, that actually reading over the story of Avram and what he did and all these things are his history, and yet they actually lead us to deeper prophecy. They are actually prophecies. Moses wrote these things about our forefather Abraham. And it was a literal thing that happened in his life, and yet there is prophetic understanding to it, because the fact that Israel never entered the Most High's full rest yet, there, you know, means in some ways they've never entered into his Sabbath yet, even though they've been keeping it literally every seventh day for 3,000 years. There's still a great Sabbath rest that mankind has yet to enter into, but he was alluding to by giving that to Israel and reestablishing. So, you know, to think that they're not real story, the real life stories that happen to real people, it is the fact that the Most High took historical things and made them prophecy for us and used people, just like it says in the book of I think it's Zechariah, where even the men like Joshua and the high priest and Zerubbabel and all those brothers were actually men. They were symbolic. They weren't actually the ones that were. Even the temple that they built didn't last. It was a sign that Israel would be restored, but that wasn't the real fulfillment, because they got plummeted again and nothing happened. And you know what I'm saying? So it's like not to say the Most High's word has failed, but yet he was still drawing out more pictures, more foreshadows of something coming for the future. So us in these times, we look at that and we find out how to apply it. And even the number 7, it means the same thing as it always has. It's the Most High thumbprint, you know. The Most High created, you know, and did things, and it was during a 7-day time period. And if you look at that, you know, 7, it always will represent a heavenly or a divine number, you know. And you know, 10, throughout the scriptures, throughout prophecy, 10 represents earthly complete. You know, it's consistent. And so when you begin to understand those things, you can unlock some of the mysteries of the prophecies. And, you know, these, it's very, very deep the way, you know, everyone's talking about it. So it's like even when he tells us not to eat of the swine, you know, it's very good not to eat swine. There's no health benefits to eating such a terrible meat. We have to stay away from those things if we want to be physically healthy. Yet some people live like a pig, and when you don't want to be closely associated with that person too. So there is some allegory to that. Like, you don't want a vulture is an unclean bird, and the way that they prey upon carcasses, you know, that we don't want those qualities in our life, so that's why we wouldn't eat something like that. And so it's deep. That's all I'm saying is that, like, it's a very deep thing. And, you know, even this prophecy that Bilaam said here, I mean, I would say it didn't even though he was, that Israel then wasn't even the fullness of what he was visualizing. The Most High gave him a vision of the greater Israel, which will be the one that is fulfilled in the very last times through Mashiach, you know. And they were a type, you know. Moses was a type of Mashiach during that time. And that's why Moses said, there will be a prophet of your people like unto me, and when you hear him, you must listen to him, you know, because he's going to lead the way, you know. And so there was going to be a greater Exodus, and Jeremiah talks about it. No longer will they say the children of Israel brought up out of Egypt, but the ones that are brought from every nation. There's going to be a greater Exodus than there ever was before, and now we're still in bondage to Egypt, symbolically. So it's, but yet it was a historical, physical reality. So that's my comment on it. You know, I just think it's so beautiful to hear everybody pass these ideas around, and just maybe we all just get a little step closer to the truth, you know?
I agree with you.
Ron, we haven't heard.
And there's room for both.
Yes, yes.
Ron, because you want to chime in?
My spin on that, the parsha that you just recited there for us was basically focused on the burnt offering part of it, where I would like to just enlighten those of us who are not really familiar with the korban, that the offering that Noahide are permitted to offer is called a burnt offering, which everything is consumed in fire on the altar. If they bring it up to Jerusalem, and also they were allowed to make their own private altars, the bimas, outside of Eretz Israel. What I wanted to mention is that the offering that we as Noahides are permitted to bring, it's actually for coming, the word sacrifice that we come to know, we translate korban to equivalent. It's actually not as accurate. It doesn't capture the entire sense of what we're actually doing, because it's actually an offering. And the root word of offering in Hebrew means coming near. And this offering helps us to come closer to God through an elevation of self. And I have in front of me here the book of Vayikra, and the Midrash says, and it says, the reason why burnt offerings, it's called the Ola offering, is mentioned first because it's one of the highest levels of offering. So I would just like to point out that us as being Benoach, we must understand that we are allowed to bring an offering, and our offering is actually considered very, it's one of the highest offerings that were brought in the times of the temple, because many times, I mean, I'm speaking as a former Christian also, we felt kind of left out of the Torah. We never felt like being part of it, because we weren't aware of the Shiva Mitzvah and the role that the Noahides play in terms of God's scheme of this world. And now that we're coming closer and we're coming through Judaism to understand our role, we have to see the importance in which God plays also on, you know, the offerings brought by the Ben Noach. So basically that's what I was researching while I was listening to the commentaries from you, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'd like to go on to the next several verses, chapter 23, verse 10. So Bilaam continued, or Balaam, that who is counted the dust of Jacob or Jacob, or numbered even a fourth of Israel? So let me die the death of the righteous, and let mine be my end be like his. So chapter 23, verse 11, and Balak said unto Bilam, you know, what have you just done to me? I'm just injecting this parenthetically. You know, I'm paying you, and I'm going back to scripture, to curse my enemies, and that's why I've hired you to be a mercenary. I'm injecting my words here. And behold, surely you have blessed them. So chapter 23, verse 12, Bilam responds and says, and I cannot say anything except which the Most High puts into my mouth, and I have to take heed. I have to literally guard it to speak it. So Balak says him in chapter 23, verse 13, so come and I pray to you that, you know, please, meaning basically please, come with me to another place that you'll see them, and the utmost part of them you'll see, and not all of them you will see, and then you can curse me from there. So verse 14 in chapter 23, so it mentions that, and he took him into the field of Sophim, which is to the top of Pisgah, and he built another seven altars, and he offered up another seven rams and seven bulls. And Bilam again said in chapter 23, verse 15, he said, stand here by your burnt offerings, and I'm going to see if I can, you know, again, encounter the Most High. So chapter 23, verse 16, and the Most High met Bilam and again put the word in his mouth and said, return to Balak and you shall speak. So, chapter 23, verse 17, and he came to him, and there was Balak standing by his burnt offerings, and the princes of Moab were with him. And Balak said to him, this is very interesting, you know, he still believed that the Most High was speaking to Bilam, and he said, what did the Most High say to him? It's very interesting that he actually used the four-letter word, the Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey. So again, there was that knowledge of the Most High's divine name. And Bilam responds, and chapter 23, verse 18, and he took up another parable, and he said, arise, Balak, and give here to me, you know, you who is the son of Tzippor. And this is a very important point here, blessed souls, which is very, all of us have to be aware of this as we, you know, vibe out on this divine image concept and inner grace. And a lot of people have a mistaken notion about the Most High. But here, the prophet of the nations at that time, Bilam says the following, chapter 3, verse 19, excuse me, the Most High is not a man that he should lie. He is the son of man, and that he should repent, I mean, he should change his mind. And when he has said, will he not do it? Or when he has spoken it, will he not make it good? Chapter 23, verse 20, he says, behold, I've been bidden to bless. And when the Most High blesses, I can't call it back. So I'd like everyone to chime in as we're coming down to 7 minutes, gentlemen. This whole idea where we started off the show talking about the divine image within the person and innate grace and their spiritual DNA, and here, not Moses, not any prophet, but actually a prophet of the Noahites comes along and says that God is not a man. And why have people injected this ideology that God became a man? Anyone like to chime in?
I would like to say, yeah, the first where I understand it, where our modern day that type of philosophy that God is a man, where you see Christianity had taught such a false doctrine, and a lot of Rastas teach that they worship a man as God, and even the Romans thought their emperor was God, and so on and so forth. Pharaoh was, they thought he was God in the flesh, and all these things. This goes all the way back to Nimrod, who lifted up himself and called himself God. And this is why Moshe wrote in the Torah that Cush fathered Nimrod. And that you know, Nimrod was the first one. And so actually, whether you look into the Indian, the Hindu religion, some of the Chinese religion, you know, like I said, Christianity, some of the European religions, the Phoenician religions, all of them have this so-called Trinity teaching, and which was and it all goes back to Nimrod and his mother, which was his wife, and the son they had named Tammuz. And they actually believe that they taught this false teaching, and it started with Babel Tower, and then the languages were split, and the this message had been carried out to the earth. And that's why in every culture they kind of did that. This is the apostasy of the children of Noah. That's why they went astray, and that's why we got to come back. The children of Noah got to come back. And Israel was given the covenant of the one God, Shema Yisrael. The Almighty is one. So, you know, that's the one thing that separates it, and he is not a man, yet he made us in his image. So that's very clear. Anyone that gets to hear this, please understand the Most High is way above us, and his thoughts are not our thoughts. And this is how we can come out of Babylon, just like our forefather Abraham.
Right. I just want to mention, and yet paradoxically, and it's a Torah of truth, that yet still we all have a divine image.
Yeah.
That doesn't make us God. Ron or Dennis, would you like to chime in? We've got 4 minutes to go.
Well, I still have the idea of the word sacrifice and offering in my mind, and that is, to me, I offer and sacrifice through prayer. And prayer, to me, is a very powerful concept that since we can't practice the physical exercise of sacrifice, prayer will suffice.
Yeah, well, you know, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, on Chanin, said that we should understand that prayer is a sacrifice in our days, and our words emanating from our mind, coming from the emotions, the passionate emotions coming from the heart, you know, actually elicit a type of energy from above that was elicited when they used to bring sacrifices in the temple. It just is said that we don't see it, but just like none of us see the energy being transmitted from all of our cell phones through the internet, through the monitor board that I'm using here on Blog Talk Radio, but we believe it's working because of the fact we're having a four-way conversation. We don't
True.
See it, but we're having this conversation. Bob, we'd like to chime in. We've got about 3 minutes to go.
I think the whole idea of the Trinity was created to mirror image off of what the impure side of what is holy and pure, which is the three. When God said, you know, God, the Torah, and Israel, and the Catholic religion, which basically started the whole Trinity of, you know, a three type. Prong of God figure was just a distortion of the actual truth that, you know, God is one, and, you know, Torah is one with God, and the soul of Israel is all also came from God, which is one, and they just distorted this into this Trinity that we so-called come to believe right now through the Greek Christian religion. Because the original Christians knew the truth, and they knew that this Trinity—they didn't incorporate this Trinity in part of their belief system.
No, yeah, exactly. They understood that the oneness what the Israel should have with the Most High is in a unity. They didn't ever think that they were the Most High. That in the Torah wasn't the Most High yet. It's His message, so it's deep. It just takes a little deeper insight, you know. And unfortunately, so many people have been scared into the false distortion. And you're right, all the devil can do is distort what is real. He's not a creator. He can't do anything.
Gentlemen,
very good point.
About 90 seconds, I want to thank Dennis Ryan from out in Long Island, and Joseph Israel from Northern California, and Ron Williams out in Queens, Long Island, and Richard Goodman signing off from Soul Talk Radio. Remember, Bessel, Soul stands for S. 7-0, original, oldest, universal laws, universal Aaron laws, because we have to remember we all have this divine image. That's the ball we should take to the scrimmage to lively up ourselves and the rest of creation for each and every nation. We'll end up with a little positive music dedicated to the healing of Jamaica. Gentlemen, thank you very much. And this is from a new album called Roots and Rights by David King called Inner Gideon. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I've been a slave. I've been a slave.
know.